Blog Talk Radio.
September 12th, 2013. This is the Rabbinic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. Tonight, we're going to discuss Dr. Ralph Metzner's book, Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond, which is the seventh in his series of books on the ecology of consciousness. All of Dr. Metzner's works are of special interest to students of the Western esoteric tradition. And I mentioned his website, www.greenearthfound.org, so you can go there and see what he has to offer. He was one of the original psychedelic experimenters and facilitators of that tempestuous era back in the 60s and early 70s, an Oxford graduate, a psychotherapist, and a philosopher. Now, his latest book will be of particular interest to students of magic who may wish to compare his system of therapeutic soul travel to the Buddhist six worlds of the Wheel of Existence, and to the nine realms of the Nordic Yggdrasil world tree, and the octaves of Pythagoras. And compare these with our own path workings on the Kabbalistic tree of life. Now, many of Dr. Metzner's insights are applicable to our venue, regardless of technique. He refers to his method as alchemical divination. That's an internal alchemy, by the way. And although we may use different techniques and different mythologies, we can always learn from the insights and the visions of a master. So, as I said, turn us on, tune us in, and don't drop out, because this will be very interesting. Now, Dr. Metzner was going to call in this evening, but he got taken away on some sort of a problem or whatever, and he may be back, and hopefully he will call in before the show's over. But I'm going to continue anyway, because I finished this book, and I'm not going to postpone the show.
I'm here. I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Oh, thank you, doctor. Oh, good.
Oh.
I was just about to wing it myself. No.
So I'm here. I was waiting for till 8 o'clock. I think I'm just on time.
Oh, maybe I'm a little late.
Sorry.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Now, I was just about to start in on your book and then wait for you to call in. Which book are we talking about? We're talking about Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond.
Which is the last one of the series. Right.
And does this book recap the series, the Ecology of Consciousness series?
Well, not exactly. I mean, I'm calling it a series because it was published one after the other and written one after the other, but they're not really, in terms of content, they're not really sequential. in other words. It's just each of the book kind of is a distillation, summary distillation, I think, of themes that I've been exploring for the last 20, 30 years, 40 years maybe.
Let me ask you a question before we go any further. You worked with Francis Israel Rigardi at one point, didn't you?
No, I never met the man. No, I never did.
You never met? Oh, I heard that you had. That's a rumor. And also, my friend and mentor Frederick Adams. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, vaguely. He's an artist, right?
Yes, right. Artist. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well,
yes, I know his art paintings. I think I have a book of art. Didn't he do like?
Nine Royal Passions, and I will send you another copy of it. We just reprinted it.
What's it called?
Nine Royal Passions of the Year.
Yes, yes.
It's an art folio, right. I will send you another copy of it when I send
it's
you up
about,
here.
It's sort of the pagan tradition of reactivating the ancient traditions of celebrating the cycles of the seasons and the moon and the sun and the planets and all of that. Yes, very beautiful.
So, yeah, well, good. I know Fred spoke very highly of you, and I hope Joe Carson's listening. She's taken over Periferia.
Is Fred Adams still alive? No,
he passed on in 1980, and we had a memorial service for him in Pasadena and buried him under a deodar, buried his ashes. To get to your book, I know you can explain this a lot better than I can, but you started off with the Tibetan six worlds of the wheel of existence, and using this as a sort of a roadmap for these path workings that we call these this sort of reveries path workings, but in your case
path working
this
is another
a,
way to look at it. Yeah, I see
right.
them as maps of, you know, I wrote a book called Maps of Consciousness, so different realms of consciousness and different stages of consciousness, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Wheel of Birth and Death, they call it, is of course a classic, and it's very profound and very deep. It's not the only way to map consciousness, but it's one very profound way that's been very influential in my
life. And I mentioned your three structures in this book were the Tibetan Wheel of Existence, and then you use the Nordic Yggdrasil World Tree, and then what was really near and dear to my heart, the Pythagorean Octaves, a la... which is very much like the psychic center system we use in the West. You know, that German psychic center system that Gitchell and Bohm and Basil Valentine developed.
I don't recognize any of those names. So that's from the magical tradition, I guess. I'm not that familiar with that literature. So come to the octave principle from Gurdjieff. That's kind of my
Gurdjieff. You mentioned Gurdjieff several times, and Melzebub's Tales of His Grandson and whatever. And I'm really fascinated with Gurdjieff too, as we all are. Starting off though on the Tibetan experiences, I thought these were fascinating. Could you talk about that a little bit?
One of the things I've done I talk about it a little bit in this book and more in the other book that I have on mind space and time stream, that it's important to make a distinction between states of consciousness and levels of consciousness and stages of consciousness development. Those are three different paradigms for looking at consciousness. Now, the state of consciousness, and there's the concept of altered states and ordinary states, is a period of time in which you're thinking that lasts, you know, in which your thinking, your perception, your feeling, and so forth works in characteristic way. And the Eastern traditions, Hindu and Buddhist philosophical traditions, recognize four kind of normal states of consciousness that we cycle through all the time. And I prefer to use that idea rather than the notion of altered state, because altered state has a kind of a connotation of something abnormal, and that there's a normal state, and then there's an abnormal kind of slightly pathological state. And that's totally misleading to think that way, because consciousness varies, cycles through these different states. And the different four normal states are the waking state, that's the one you and I are both in now, that lasts from the time that you wake up till the time you fall asleep. Then there's the sleeping state and the dreaming state, and those are two completely different states, which we now know, modern science has shown, that the brain waves are different and the eyeballs move and so forth. Those are the states when your thinking is quite different. Your thinking, your perception, your feeling, and time and space are completely different. For example, you can in a dream go and travel and visit your grandmother who lives thousands of miles away, and it doesn't take any time whatsoever. You don't have to go 5 hours in an airplane. You're as close as you feel. In other words, time and space are subjective and emotional rather than objective and measured in time. And then the fourth state is kind of a meditative state. And then there are kind of altered states, and the states of course, induced by drugs and alcohol and things like that, and by stress, and states induced by meditation practices. And then there are states of, it's important to distinguish between expanded and contracted states. For example, the states of when you're working creatively and meditating, those can be thought of as expanded states. But when your contracted states are when you're concentrating. Concentration means concentration is a narrowing of focus. If you're giving a concert or you're working on your computer, your consciousness is very focused, and focus means you're not aware of other things. Of course, you can change your consciousness, and that's the whole thing. That's where it goes into psychopathology and so forth. Because our consciousness can be captured. And the two main things that capture and contract our awareness are fear and rage. Because when you're afraid, you're focused on what it is that, it is that feels threatening to you. And when you're enraged, it's the same thing, except the only difference being in the one case you're afraid and you want to run away, and the other case you want to move towards an attack. And but it's very focused, you see. And So in my book Mind, Space, and Time Stream, I talk about that. And in the book Worlds Within and Worlds Without, I look at the Wheel of Life. The Tibetan book of Tibetan Buddhist teachings have this Wheel of Life, where they have these six worlds, what they call six worlds of existence. And I think of those, I analyze those as states of consciousness. In other words, for example, one of them is the world of the asuras. Those are the warriors. That's the state you're in when you're fighting, when you're thinking. And so it's important to think of these things as being the way you think, the way you feel, the way you focus. When you're focused on getting something, you know, that you want to get, and attacking and taking, then that's the asura world. These are not. Of course, the Buddhists say, well, these are special kinds of demons, but what my interpretation of this, these are states of consciousness that apply to everybody. And, for example, I say in my book that when a person loses their temper and, starts attacking somebody in an angry voice, or even worse, attacking them physically, then they're captured in the asura state of consciousness. And then there's the heaven and hell. And the heaven and hell world is like a beautiful, heaven is a beautiful, blissful state. The Buddhists are very interesting, where they don't say heaven is the goal that you want to get to, like in Christianity. They say, well, it's just a temporary condition where everything is fine, you know, roses all the way. You're feeling good and you're nothing to worry about. But it's a temporary state, and after a while, they all end. Hell is the place where you're feeling tortured and so forth. And one of the six states is called the human realm. In the human realm, they say, that's the one you really want to be in, because it has all the possibilities of the other realms, but it has, in addition, the possibility of growth and understanding and development, and that's the difference. So the other realms then can be thought of as contracted examples that are there that we cycle through, but that we ideally want to get out of. And so in my book, that's the way I interpret it, as a psychological teaching of great profundity. I mean, I'm totally amazed how profound it is, because it describes the conditions in each of those four realms and how you get into them and how you get out of them. Because in the mandala paintings, you'll see in each of the six realms, there's a Buddha figure giving a teaching, giving a symbolic teaching on how to get into that realm. And then, of course, around the outside rim, there's this chain of 12-fold links of a chain showing the karmic conditions which lead one to go into one of these realms. So it's not a linear sequence. You don't go one and then the other and then the other like that. You can go get into them at any time from one to the other. And, of course, the ideal is through the practice of mindfulness and meditation, you want to always get back to the human realm, because that's the one from which you can become enlightened.
You mentioned Carl Jung. Yeah. You mentioned Carl Jung and the collective unconscious, and that's near to my heart. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your theories on the reality of spirits, because I've been linking this to the collective unconscious myself,
we get so many criticisms
from people who just don't seem to understand that these spirits have a reality that's transpersonal. They don't understand this. And could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, Jung made a fantastic contribution. I mean, you got to remember that he lived in the first half of the 20th century, right? He died in like 1954 or something like that. So that was still, you know, the heyday of the materialist worldview. So his great contribution was following in the lineage of Freud, who said, well, you know, we've got this realm that we think we're conscious all the time, but actually there's this whole unconscious realm that's, you know, causes us all kinds of troubles. And Jung said, well, yeah, that's true, but it also is the possibility that there's the greater unconscious which may have positive things to it, creativity and spirituality and impulses like that. And not only do individuals have a consciousness, but there's a collective consciousness that's shared by all human beings. And then later Jungians have expanded that and have said, well, there's a group unconscious, and then what Jung called the collective unconscious would be the realm of consciousness shared by all human beings. And then Jungians later came and said, well, there's realms of consciousness shared by some human beings, but not necessarily all. For example, Christian images of Madonna and Child is a sort of a universal archetype, but it's also specifically oriented toward, it's a cultural, so there's a layer that's the cultural unconscious. And so I think of it as layers. There's the individual consciousness, and then there's group consciousness. For example, a family might have a level of consciousness. I prefer to talk about levels of consciousness rather than unconscious, because when you say unconscious, it means the opposite of consciousness, you see. It means unconscious. As soon as you become conscious of something unconscious, it's not unconscious anymore. So there's a consciousness, a level of consciousness shared by a family, for example, then by a tribe or a group, and then by a whole culture, and then by all human beings. That would be Jung's collective unconscious, the archetypes, what he called the archetypes, a sort of basic principles. And they're based on sort of basic human relations. For example, the archetype of the mother. Well, everybody has a mother, so everybody knows, you know, in the most basic sense, the experience of mother. And then, of course, different cultures make different images of the mother goddess and different forms of the multiple forms. Those are the kinds of things. And the father god, same thing. Jung wrote about that. But in my book Green Psychology, I take it a little bit further, and I say, well, in a way, you got to realize that consciousness is just not just human. because after all, you know, it's very clear, animals and plants and other forms, everything is conscious, everything. Of course, it's a different kind of consciousness, of course. But we participate in it because we're also, so there's a level, there's a realm of consciousness that's shared by all, not only human beings, but all animals and all plants.
Which brings us to the general, we call that
the Gaia. People now call that Gaia.
That leads me to your interest in and your exposition of general systems theory, that Bertalanque's general systems theory, and that relates right to what you're saying. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Well, general systems theory is a formulation that uses the idea of systems, and the basic idea of systems is that you've got to look at the different levels and that not prioritize any one level. See, mainstream physics and mainstream science keeps thinking that the most ultimate reality is the lowest down on the scale and the atoms, and now then you're going to go down below into the subatomic and the subnuclear down into, and they build these, you know, $50 billion a year cyclotrons where they're smashing the atoms to see these quarks and these evanescent particles that, you know, it takes billions and billions of dollars to photograph them and so on. And somehow this is the ultimate reality. Well, that's not ultimate. There is no one ultimate reality. It's a we live in a multidimensional universe. And for us, the realm that we're focused in is the human realm. And then there's the realm above us, so to speak, in the human realm, then you go up to the collective human realm, what Jung would call the collective human consciousness, or the collective unconscious, the collective human consciousness, and then the planetary consciousness, that's Gaia. But then you go beyond that to the solar system, that's the consciousness that includes Mars and Venus and all the planets of our solar system. Then you go beyond that, that's the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. But why stop there? You could go further, and physics tells us, well, this is only one of, you know, billions and billions of galaxies in the universe, you know, hundreds of thousands of billions of galaxies in the universe, and clusters of galaxies, and you go to cosmic consciousness. So it's systems. You know, the systems approach allows you to specify the system in which you're talking and how systems relate to the systems above, so to speak, and the systems below. And of course, human beings have a body, and the body is made up of organs, and the organs are made up of cells, and the cells are made up of molecules, and the molecules are made up of atoms, and the atoms are made up of particles. We participate in that as well. You know, and like the Hermetic philosopher used to say, as above, so below. The microcosmos and the macrocosmos correspond to one another. And we obviously participate in it. You know, our bodies are made up of atoms and molecules and cells and organs and da da. And the solar system, da 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 da.
In the Hermetic tradition, of course, we use the Kabbalistic tree of life as a schematic and the four worlds of the Kabbalah to hang these concepts on. But in your book, you're using it very, very.
I could have used that Kabbalah thing, and I've used it personally. There's many different ways of mapping these different realms of consciousness. Yes, and
you chose Yggdrasil, the world tree, which is really more applicable to that whole the shamanism that goes all the way from Central Asia all the way through Northern Europe, and that was a good choice. Would you talk about the relation to Yggdrasil?
And I related to the conceptions of modern science, because I think it's not enough just to say, well, this is what the esoteric theories say, because then there's this big gap, there's this big split in our culture between what mainstream scientists say and then these other traditions which are esoteric or strange or weird, and we don't really know how to relate to them. And I'm trying to say, well, it's one world. There are different world views. Each world view is partial. It's impossible to get a worldview that's complete. How could that ever be? It's a delusion. But each is a partial way, an incomplete perspective on a whole that's forever mysterious and open-ended. And so You know, then there's other ways in the esoteric traditions of talking about the levels of consciousness. For example, in many of the esoteric traditions, they talk about different domains of consciousness that the human participate in, like the astral world and the causal world and like that. I'm not talking about that system. That's another system of dividing up or mapping out the different realms of consciousness. That's really been my approach all along, is to look in a comparative ways at different ways of mapping reality, both the internal reality of our own consciousness and the external reality of the world around us, and in that way recognizing the relativity, so we don't get fixated of this is the ultimate reality, you know, like modern scientists say, well, this is the way it actually is, so don't give me all this esoteric stuff, you see. They don't want to know about it because it's not scientific. And mainstream science is like that. And, you know, but philosophers of science have shown that science itself has these paradigms, and it kind of gets tied into the paradigms. And I listen a lot and read a lot of the talks and given by the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama has said, well, you know, because his Buddhist, in the Buddhist traditions, they talk a lot about these different realms of consciousness. And he says science, modern science, Western science needs to recognize the reality of what he calls first-person empiricism. And first-person empiricism is the empiricism of your own subjective consciousness. Well, William James called it actually subjective, the subjective realm is equally real. The subjective realm should not be dismissed as mainstream sciences, which is fixated on the time-space-material dimension, dismisses the subjective realm and calls it merely subjective, and that's false, because the subjective realm is as infinite as the objective. That goes
ever
back to Heraclitus.
Ever since René Descartes, we've taken that imaginative realm and relegated it to delusion.
Descartes and the whole scientific revolution with Newton and all the physicists in the 17th century, because the reason for that was because the church had a monopoly on the subjective. The church said to the material scientists like Newton and Galileo, okay, so you can go ahead and measure matter and energy and light and da-da-da, but don't talk about consciousness and don't talk about the subjective and don't talk about spirit of spirituality, because that's our department and you stay out of it, or we'll cut your head off and burn you at the stake, which in fact they did for Giordano Bruno, they put people in prison, like what's his name they put in prison.
Yeah, went along with this the anima mundi and the living earth idea, very very much so. Even rocks and all are alive. And right. And I noticed it here in the book, and I was really near to fascinating. You mentioned sacred mountains, and you even mentioned Mount Shasta. And we just got back from taking a little meditative trip up to Mount Shasta, we were actually in contact with some divas and what have you. And I thought that section in your book was just really fascinating. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. That's right. So even if the modern biologists, even then the Gaia theory, would say, okay, so all of life is interconnected. So going to James Lovelock and Vernadsky and others, well, the whole planet is alive. The geology and the rocks and everything interacts and is alive. And so that's not that different from acknowledging, if spirits are in living things, but then the realms of esoteric sciences used to call the mineral kingdom the first kingdom, and then they called the plants the second kingdom and the animals the third kingdom. And science doesn't use that terminology. you know, they talk the first kingdom is the kingdom of bacteria, and the second kingdom, the kingdom of multicellular organisms, and then the third kingdom is the kingdom of, you know, plants and animals and fungi and things like that. And then, in the esoteric traditions, everything is alive with spirituality. And of course, the spirits are different. The spirits of the mineral world and the metal world are different than the spirits of the plant world and the animal world. Of course they are, and the human world. Why wouldn't they be? But it's a recognition of a reality that's normally hidden, but only hidden to ordinary sense perception. And some people, because their senses are naturally expanded, we call them clairvoyant or clairsentient. And then more increasingly, people are developing instrumentation that can measure these subtle energies. And so that's the kind of philosophical background that I'm trying to lay out. But it's just, you know, it's all within the realm of science. So I'm a committed empiricist. I'm not just putting out these teachings or doctrines. This is what you have to observe. These are realms that are open to observation.
Well, we personify these spirits as gnomes and sylphs and salamanders and undines, we personify them. In order to contact a gnome, you'd have to slow yourself way down. You know, and then you get yourself slowed way down to their speed, and then they're easier to contact.
That's one way of doing it. And then, in other words, in different altered states, you may come into contact with them. Of course, my work came out of all the work with consciousness expanding substances, where perceptions of non-material spirit beings and entities is quite common. Even although many people don't recognize it that way, and they just think of it as a kind of a weird hallucination, they call it an entity. But people throughout history in all traditions have reported, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity is full of language describing spirits and ghosts. And in the Christian tradition, you know, they veer a little bit towards a kind of a dualistic conception. I mean, they have demons and angels, you know, good spirits and bad spirits. But in medieval times, you know, like with Thomas Aquinas, they had the Catholic theologians had very elaborate descriptions of the different realms of angels, the different realms of demons. And look at Dante's, you know, Divine Comedy, where he has all the descriptions of the many different kinds of demons. Basically, I think the Christian conception compared to the Buddhist conception, I think, is kind of limited, tell you the truth, because, you know, you just have heaven, hell, and purgatory. And Buddhism has a lot more than that.
Well,
the interesting conception of heaven, you know, is quite interestingly different. In heaven, in the Buddhist tradition, is not the goal to get to heaven. In the Christian tradition, it's eschatological. You know, I'm not trying to be critical of Christianity, but I'm saying the dogma. The dogma is, you know, you're good and you don't commit sins and you pray and so forth, and after death you'll come to heaven. Well, from a esoteric point of view, whether Buddhist, Hindu, or any other Christian esoteric, that's a gross oversimplification, because it denies the reality of incarnation and reincarnation. See, that's a big problem for Christianity, because that, you know, in the 4th century, that was taken out of Christian teaching. It used to be part of it.
Of course.
And Jesus taught, you know, incarnation. He said, I'm the reincarnation of Elijah. It was by doing that, it fixates people on just this life. And then, you know, after this life, you've got these three alternatives, heaven, hell, and purgatory, which is kind of scary and limiting and not true. So,
ever since Constantine, Christianity has been a political machine. I mean, they politicized it.
Yes, they politicize it, because then it gives the power to church to say, you got to focus on doing good things and not doing bad things. in this life and paying your dues to the church. So we'll pray for you and do all the ceremonies and do all the right things, and you know, you have better chances of avoiding hell and going to at least to purgatory and you know, like that. So I don't know whether I should tell you the story, but this is actually true. I once met in my travels a young woman in Germany. She was in her 20s, and she told me she'd been raised by nuns, educated by nuns, and she told me that she was a very dutiful young woman, young girl, and she, the nuns had nun school, you know, convent school had all these rules and regulations, and they had you know, lists of sins and penalties, and how many years you would spend in purgatory as a penalty for committing these sins and breaking these rules that they had set up. And she kept track, and she wrote all their sins down and the penalties down. And by the time she was like 17 years, she calculated in her little notebook that she was going to spend 1.5 million years in purgatory. And when I heard that, I mean, I got enraged, I have to admit. I got enraged at a system that would do that to a young person, that would do that kind of punitive brainwashing to a young person. And I am happy to say for her and for humanity that shortly thereafter she left the, you know, she left the convent school and put it all behind her. But that's
of course,
a very malignant time.
Yeah, right. As you know, the Hermetic tradition was classical paganism's last attempt to compete with Christianity and offer something.
But it was secret. See, Hermetic means they don't talk about it. It's sealed. It's a closed book.
That's right. It's too esoteric.
Not because they want to be secrecy mongering,
but
they don't want to, you know, they don't want to lose their job or their life.
Right, yeah.
You know, stay away from these over eager proselytizers that want to impose their dogma on other people. So, that's been the issue of established religions, so forth. They get interwoven with power systems of power and control, and then they lose it. And that's why the true spirituality goes underground and says, well, you know, we have to participate in it because we're citizens of our country, of our state, or whatever, of our time, or time and place where we live. But nevertheless, let's not get hung up.
Yeah, right.
But it does get tricky because about education?
Yeah.
And see, the whole science had to go through this whole thing of establishing the right to pursue their agenda free of interference. And we're sort of stuck with that because they said the church, they finally worked out a deal. I talk about this in my book, Green Psychology, where they worked out this deal in the 17th century. They had all these scientists like Newton and Galileo and Kepler and others, and they said, well, we just want to do this science, and we're going to focus on the material world. We're not going to get into realms of psyche or consciousness or spirit and morality because that's your thing. And the church said, okay, fine, go ahead, do it, you know, and stay out of our affairs. And that gave the scientists room to do their thing. But the problem is, that system then got established, so scientists won't talk about spirit, and they won't talk about spirits because they can't see them, and they can't measure them, and they don't even like to go there because they feel uneasy. But why do they feel uneasy? Because the church no longer has that kind of a control over people. See, the Inquisition is long gone. Most people don't even consider themselves believers. But they say, well, we can't go there because we can't observe it. It's not observable. And that's not true.
And if they do go there, they lose their scientific status.
That's right.
Rupert Sheldrake is a good example.
Yes, exactly. He talks about these subtle energy fields that can be perceived and not perceived, and they can even be measured. They stretch across time. But, you know, he's been demonized, but he's fighting a valiant battle, and he's established a foothold, so to speak, and But see, William James laid it all out over 100 years ago because he talked about radical empiricism. He said, radical empiricism has two parts. One part is the empirical credo that everybody's agreed is that all knowledge must be based on observation. And then the second part, which is the radical part, is don't exclude any area from observation by your preconceived ideas. And that's what modern science doesn't do. And that's why modern science, for example, can't look at parapsychology. And William James looked at parapsychological threats. He said clairvoyance and telepathy and all these things. And they said they don't look at the effects of psychedelic or consciousness-expanding drugs because they always say, well, it's just a drug effect. The drug has deranged the brain, and therefore that whatever you see it does has no possible validity or relevance to anything. See, and William James didn't do that. He did studies with nitrous oxide. And
that brings me to a question I want to ask you, and I think this is a question that our listeners would like to have resolved also, or somehow shed some light on it. We wonder, we have this kind of wonder. In fact, Lauren and I were talking about it tonight at dinner. What is the plant, the various plants that we know and love, are they carrying something like McKenna discussed? Do they have an intelligence and a message that they carry, data that they carry, or are they just simply activating that which is in our deep minds and deep memories?
Or is it both?
Is it a combination of both?
Oh, it's totally. We're totally. All human life is totally, all animal life and plant life are totally interwoven with each other at every level. At the most basic level, we animals breathe in what the plants breathe out, because the plants breathe out oxygen and they breathe in carbon dioxide. They neutralize carbon dioxide, which is what we breathe out. And that we being all animals, air-breathing mammals, that's the basic equation of life, which of course now is being destroyed by because we're cutting down the trees, which take up the carbon dioxide and produce the oxygen, and at the same time as we're depleting the all of that. So we've been interfering, but plants provide us with food. So besides the basic cycle of air, if the plants weren't producing oxygen, we couldn't live. And so then they provide us with food, with nourishment. They provide us with clothing, with medicine, and with visions and understanding, and with beauty. And we use plants to build the structures of our world. And so it's a completely symbiotic relationship. Not only humans with plants, but all animals with plants, and humans specifically with plants and also with other animals. It's a symbiotic, multiple interdependences, not dependency, not independence, but interdependency. Mutual. That's a systems view, you see. They're connected. It's not like one is more real than the other.
In an overall sense, yes, I would say, we have to agree in an overall sense, but specifically, am I eating, if I'm eating something, wisdom that I didn't have before and wasn't in me? That's the question. McKenna, of course, would say, "Oh yeah," and they even come from outer space.
It's a very mysterious process. It's a very mysterious process. When you're eating a plant, well, in the first place, you're eating sunlight because the plant has eaten sunlight and converted its sunlight using chlorophyll to green matter, which we then eat. That's what the alchemist called the green lion eats the sun. That's one of the core alchemical images called the green lion eats the sun. So what does that mean? The green lion is a symbol of plant and animal life combined. Because green is all animal life, all green life, all plant life. All animal life. So green lion eats the sun. So plants eat sunlight, and animals eat plant. So therefore, the green line eats the sun,
right,
describes the basic biosphere dynamics on the planet. It's an incredible thing.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. And you like, I noticed you have several references to and plates from Atlanta Fugians in your book.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've been digging through that for years and found a great deal of wisdom in that.
Yeah, a lot of the alchemical texts are descriptions of meditative processes. Like that one I have in the book is a description of a meditative process, which I describe right next to it. You know, where you have these force energy, light energy spheres in your body like suns. That's why I showed the two diagrams next to it.
That's almost a diagram of Rigardi's middle pillar exercise, which is a very simplified version of the Western chakra system.
Right.
And I appreciate you pointing that out too. Because,
well, and in the Kabbalah, it's the same thing. They have the tree of life in the Kabbalah. They have the tree, one in the middle, and then one on the left and one on the right. You know, these are all with the different Sephiroth. Each of them is focusing light energy. Light energy is a meditative process, energy that can be directed intention.
A couple of things I want to catch up on before we sign off, because we're running close to the end of the hour here. In your third section, you're talking significantly about the octaves, the Pythagorean octaves.
Right.
And this is, of course, I remember Fred Adams made monochords. He was making monochords. He had monochords 6 feet long and doing these. This is fascinating. And I notice you're very much into the writings of Jocelyn Godwin, who is a wonderful musicologist and a Hermetic scholar.
Yeah,
do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm not a scholar of music, but I mean, I'm coming basically from the Gurdjieff, Uspensky kind of using the octave as a scheme of describing, analyzing all kinds of processes, evolutionary processes, and creative processes in a series of seven steps. And I give like three examples of that in the book, and of course there are many, many more examples. And I think it's just a developmental scheme of how a process might develop. But what I liked about the Gurdjieff and the Uspensky approach too is that they say it's not inevitable. I mean, there is a theoretical octave, you know, which you can play, and you can play a theoretical octave on the piano. But in actual fact, in musical creation and expression, for example, and life, the way it's expressed, doesn't just play an octave going up and down. That would be kind of boring. This would be a scale, you see. So it makes variations all the time using the octave principle, and then chords and harmonic combinations of intervals and like that. So it's a very deep, very profound kind of paradigm for analyzing processes of all kinds that extend over time. And that's why I use it, you know, I call it an octave of global civilization. And the octave of global civilization is obviously incomplete, and we may never complete it. We may blow the planet up, or we may, you know, go into a degenerative state where we're reduced to some primitive condition again because of the excesses of our nature-destroying civilization, but at least to lay out the possible steps gives us a way of thinking about it that might expand awareness into something more hopeful. So that's the reason why I use that. I find it's a very interesting. I'm not claiming any kind of, you know, total truth to the predictions or the scheme that I lay out in terms of. But it's a preliminary mapping, and to be tested and adapted and as time goes on through the observations that we make.
I see a certain synergy here with that Redfield's book, The Celestine Prophecy, and what you're...
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
I don't want to force that on you. But it seems like some of your ideas are similar. And I love that book.
Yeah.
Now, you are conceding, I notice you're on page 129, you're conceding that we might have to wait for an apocalypse to clear things off before we can do this.
I don't believe I say that. I don't have to wait for the apocalypse at all. No, I think it's absurd to wait for the apocalypse. I mean,
we're not waiting for it, but
I just wanted to make sure you get that.
Yeah, right. This latest book, Dan Brown's Inferno, he's a pulp fiction writer, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But he has chapter 22. He lays out the population explosion. If you don't read the book for anything else but chapter 22,
right.
that's kind of scary.
I don't like to do that. I don't see the point of scaring people. Things are scary enough without adding to it.
Right.
I'd rather lay out some possibilities of how we might go beyond this whole process, you know, and really change the thing in a fundamental way. By the way, are you going to give me a chance at some point to mention my website and link?
Yes, I was just about
connect people
that
to my books.
We're just, all right, let me run this down first. This book that we've been discussing tonight is the seventh in a series called The Ecology of Consciousness. The first one is The Expansion of Consciousness. Second one is The Roots of War and Domination. Third one is Alchemical Divination. Fourth one is Mind, Space, and Time Stream. Fifth one is The Life Cycle of the Human Soul. The sixth is The Six Pathways of Destiny. And the seventh is the one we are discussing tonight, Worlds Within and Worlds Beyond, all by the distinguished philosopher, Dr. Ralph Metzger. And your website is greenearthfound.org. That's all one word, greenearthfound.org.
Yeah, it's short for Green Earth Foundation.
Or Green Earth Foundation.
Yeah.
And absolutely fascinating work, and I am going to study, or I'm going to get all the books in the series, and I'm going to study them carefully because I've been doing this somewhat similar work for the past 40 years, and I've learned.
Wow.
I'll tell you honestly, I've learned a lot from this book. I really have.
Well, thank you.
That's what
an author loves to hear. It's music to my ears.
Well, your insights and your concise. I mean, so much of this sort of thing is presented in such a blizzard of fluff, but you're concise, right to the point, and just really insightful.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. I'm going to send you. I'll send you a Seventh Ray, a copy of Fred's art folio, surface mail. I'll get your surface mail address later. So next week, right along this line, and you may know these fellows, we're going to be discussing the mushroom that started all of this off, and we'll be discussing Clark Heinrich's Strange Fruit, Alchemy and Religion, The Hidden Truth, and also a book by Carl A.P. Ruck, Mark A. Harlan, and Jose Chaldron, called Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, the drug cult that civilized Europe. So that's next week, and thank you so much, Dr. Metzger.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Shall I give you my address, or...?
Hang on a second. Let me write it down in the book here on pencil so I can go ahead and send this up. Okay. go ahead.
It's 18210 Robin Avenue, like the bird Robin, R-O-B-I-N, Avenue. Sonoma, S-O-N-O-M-A, California.
S-O-N-O-M-A, Sonoma, California. Okay.
95476.
95476.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Doctor.
All right.
And,
I'll look forward to that. Thank you for inviting
me. We'll have you on again. Right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
And the rest of you, be sure and tune in next week, and we'll talk about that. Oh boy, the big red top next week, and that ought to be a good one. So until then, good magic.